are listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel on Wednesday, the 27th of March. In the headlines, Staff Sergeant Nissim Kachlon from the Givati Brigade is killed in action in the southern Gaza Strip. Zaher Bashara, a Druze factory worker, is killed in a Hezbollah rocket strike in Kiryat Shmona. Troops discover a new tunnel network in Khan Yunis' Amal neighborhood. Efforts to reach a compromise on the Haredi IDF exemption bill are deadlocked. Three Palestinians are killed during an IDF raid on Jenin. And the weather unseasonably hot over the next few days. Good evening, this is Mark Weiss with the news. The IDF reports that Staff Sergeant Nissim Kachlon, age 21, a soldier from the Givati Brigade's 435th Battalion from Khadera, was killed in battle in the southern Gaza Strip. On day 173 of the Israel-Hamas war, a rocket barrage from Lebanon on Kiryat Shmona and surrounding communities this morning killed one person and wounded two other people. Zaher Bashara, a 38-year-old resident of the Druze village Ein Kinya on the Golan Heights, was killed when a rocket struck his place of work in the Kiryat Shmona industrial zone. A civilian and an IDF soldier were likely hurt in other locations, also hit by rockets. More than 30 rockets were fired at the Galilee Panhandle communities at 8 a.m. this morning. Heavy damage was caused to buildings and cars in Kiryat Shmona. The rocket salvo came several hours after an Israel Air Force strike in Lebanon killed seven terrorists from the Al-Jamma al-Ismailia organization, which has been responsible for firing on Israel in recent weeks. A reporter says Israeli fighter aircraft struck a building where the terrorists were and apparently thwarted a planned attack. We spoke about the attack on the Galilee Panhandle with Kiryat Shmona's deputy security officer, Ariel Frisch.
Well, we got attacked at 8 o'clock in the morning. We got attacked by about 30 missiles attack, different and various size of missiles, part of them very, very big. We got it with five waves of attacks, one by one. And during these attacks, we got great damage, and we had also a casualty of one man that got killed by the missile attack. And it's very sad.
We understand the man who was killed was a Druze resident of the Golan Heights. What was he doing in Kiryat Shmona?
He was at his workplace in his industry.
And how was he killed exactly?
Well, he got hit by the missile.
And he was in a factory when this happened?
Yes.
Is this the worst attack on Kiryat Shmona since the beginning of the Gaza war?
I wouldn't say it's the worst, but it's one of the biggest.
And how have residents there responded? I understand that the vast majority of Kiryat Shmona has already been evacuated, but some 3,000 or so people remain. What are they feeling now?
Well, they are very frightened, but most of them are essential workers, so they will not leave even though.
Do you expect the government to respond to today's attack in a more forceful manner than it has over the last few months?
I expect the government not to react and to respond. I expect them to solve the problem. It's not sustainable and it's not a real option to keep this game. And it's a game. They shoot, we shoot, they shoot, we shoot. It's not a way to live. We need her security, we need her peace, and we expect the government to make whatever it demands in order to give us what we deserve, peaceful life in Kiryat Shmona, secure life in Kiryat Shmona, and whatever it means, and whatever it needs to do, we expect them to do.
What does security mean for you? Presumably you would want all the Hezbollah gunmen, the Radwan force, removed north of the Litani River.
It's not all just the men to be removed. It's to destroy every option of threat, which means the structures, the infrastructures, the missiles, the silos, whatever Hezbollah has that can threaten our life, our peaceful life, must be destroyed, eliminated, and must be enforced that it will not be built again.
Presumably this means all-out war.
Or it means that great nations will take the responsibility to take care of whatever it needed to be. Because I do believe that if the great nations will decide to enforce the law, it will happen. But if they send only the United Nations force, it doesn't do anything. And we are here in this big trouble because the United Nations decided the 1701 decision and no one enforced it. But if, let's say, the United States of America will take care of it and their army will enforce it, it will be different. At least I can believe they have the power to enforce it.
So you're talking about some kind of international peacekeeping force in South Lebanon?
No, internationally. Talking about, we have in the Tausi, near Yemen, the coalition that takes care of the Houthis. Same coalition, if it will enforce the peace in the north, could work. But they need to decide that they want to be here. And you know that they are not really thrilled about this idea. So it's either the diplomatic solution, which will be enforced by armies that can enforce it, or we will have to take it by ourselves.
As we mentioned earlier, some 21,000 residents, approximately, of Kiryat Shmona have been evacuated to hotels all over the country and relatives and friends. Do you believe many of them will not come back unless they feel it's secure?
I truly fear it. I don't know, because you cannot ask a man or a woman when they have uncertainty about the future. What will they do? The only way to ask the people to come back is after they get the conditions that met to be in a peaceful place, a secure place, and then you can ask them, will you come back or will you not? Now it's unfair to even ask this question.
Kiryat Shmona's Deputy Security Officer, Ariel Frisch. Omri Sofer, the commander of the community security detail at Kibbutz Misgav Am, said the idea of quiet will be answered with quiet has disappeared. The doctrine that defined Israel's defense strategy on October the 6th, that assumed our enemies didn't want to harm civilians, just soldiers, and the soldiers were located on the back lines behind the civilians. That approach died on October the 7th, he said. At the end of the day, we demand one simple thing, to live with security. The director of the Upper Galilee Economic Development Company, former Knesset member Inbar Bezek, says not one single Knesset member showed up for a Knesset discussion to discuss the damage to the northern businesses as a result of the war. She said, we left at 4 a.m. from the Upper Galilee to get to the meeting, which was scheduled at 9 a.m, and no one besides the committee chair turned up. Apparently, 9 a.m. is too early for them. In repeated raids by the IDF forces on the Al-Amal neighborhood in Khan Yunis, new tunnels have been discovered, some of which reach nearby Nasser Hospital. As part of the operation in the neighborhood, 50 terrorists were apprehended and will be interrogated. Meanwhile, at the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, terrorists and Hamas commanders are still entrenched in the medical complex, where the fighting continues. So far, 500 terrorists, operatives from the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, have been arrested and 170 killed. The IDF spokesperson last night confirmed that the deputy commander of the Hamas military wing, Marwan Issa, was killed, along with another senior Hamas figure, in an Israeli airstrike in the Nusirat refugee camp in central Gaza Strip earlier this month. 134 captives are held in Gaza. At least 98 of them are believed to be alive. The IDF announced last night that Uriel Baruch, who was kidnapped from the area of the Nova rave on October the 7th, was murdered in captivity and his body is held by Hamas. Baruch, 35, from Jerusalem, is survived by his wife and two children. Yamit Ashkenazi, whose sister Doron Steinbrecher is held in Gaza, says the courageous testimony of released hostage Amit Susana on the sexual assault and violence she experienced in captivity must propel decision makers to make difficult decisions and bring all the hostages home. Susana, whose testimony was published in the New York Times, is the first released hostage to publicly share details of the sexual assault she was subject to in captivity. IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari says Hamas wants to escalate the war and is delaying the negotiations on a hostage release and a ceasefire deal. In an English-language statement, Hagari first commented on the testimony published in the New York Times yesterday by Amit Susana, a former hostage who described the sexual violence he was subject to during captivity.
Today, in the New York Times, the testimony of Amit Susna was published. This is an important document, this testimony. Amit Susna from Kfar Aza was kidnapped on the 7th of October by Hamas and was held captive for 55 days. Amit Susna suffered sexual violence in her captivity by her captor. This is an horrific testimony. This is a wake-up call to the world to act, to do everything and pressure Hamas to free our hostages, to bring our hostages home. 134 hostages in horrific conditions under the captivity of Hamas. This is why we are in Gaza. This is why we fight. Hamas can stop the war tomorrow, releasing 134 hostages immediately and surrendering. But Hamas chooses not to do so. He's delaying the negotiation. His leaders, Ismail Haniyeh, chose to stop the negotiation and fly where? Fly to Iran to consult the Iranian leadership. This is Iran. This is Hamas. They want to escalate the region. Our war is against Hamas, not against the people of Gaza. We do everything we can to distinguish between the terrorists of Hamas to the innocent people of Gaza. We are coordinating and facilitating a humanitarian effort by land, air, and sea. This is a tremendous effort. We will keep on doing so and increasing this effort. We are not a bottleneck to any humanitarian aid. We have opened new roads at land and from the sea, and we will keep on doing so. These days, we are coordinating and planning with our friends from United States Central Command the temporary pier. This pier will provide more aid into Gaza. It will flood Gaza with aid. The problem is yet the distribution problem. Because of whom? Because of Hamas. Hamas is stealing the aid from the ones in need, from the women and the children. There is also looting. We are acting with the international organizations, and I'm calling the international organizations and the countries that are working with us to find solutions with Israel for the distribution mechanism. We will do everything we can and keep on flooding Gaza with aid and looking for solutions for the distribution mechanism. Our war is against Hamas. Our war is to bring back home our 134 hostages. Our war is against Hamas, not against the people of Gaza.
IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari. The war cabinet is expected to convene this evening against the backdrop of the return of the Israeli team from Qatar and the impasse in talks after Hamas's negative response to an American proposal Israel agreed to. Sources in Jerusalem said earlier that only military pressure from the IDF alongside pressure by mediators Qatar and Egypt could bring a change in Hamas's negative stance. According to the sources, Qatar could threaten expelling Hamas leaders from its territory or threaten to close the terror group's bank accounts in the country. Earlier, it was reported that the main point of disagreement centres on the return of displaced Gazans to the northern part of the enclave. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Wednesday his cancellation of a planned visit to Washington by top aides this week was meant to show Hamas that Israel would not bend to growing international pressure to halt the war in Gaza. He was speaking during a meeting in Jerusalem with visiting U.S. Senator Rick Scott.
I thought the U.S. decision in the Security Council was very, very bad move. Yeah. And the worst part about it, I think the bad thing about the U.S. decision in the United Nations Security Council was it encouraged Hamas to take a hard line and to believe that international pressure will prevent Israel from, A, freeing the hostages and destroying Hamas. And that, therefore, my decision not to send the delegation to Washington in the wake of that resolution was a message to Hamas. It was a message, first and foremost, to Hamas. Don't bet on this pressure. It's not going to work. And I hope they got the message.
Prime Minister Netanyahu. It was reported tonight that the Prime Minister is now seeking to rearrange the meeting he cancelled. Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer, one of the two Israeli officials that was due to go to Washington, discussed the growing division between the US and Israel in a Bloomberg TV interview, saying Washington's decision not to veto this week's Security Council resolution on the Gaza ceasefire represented a change in US policy.
Well, I believe their policy that has been pretty consistent, John, since the beginning of the war about 6 months ago, was to not accept a ceasefire that would be unconditional, and it would have to be connected to an agreement to release hostages. Unfortunately, in this text that was passed, those two issues were separated for the first time. In fact, 5 days before, there was a resolution that the United States put forward that was vetoed by China and Russia. And one of the reasons why they vetoed it is because it connected those two issues. And if you look at the text, and everyone can go see it on the UN website, and you look at the resolution 5 days ago, and you look at the resolution that passed yesterday, you'll see a huge difference. And unfortunately, that's a change in U.S. policy. Now, I'm glad to hear that John Kirby said it's not a change in U.S. policy, and I hope that they will continue to connect those two issues. But that's not the text of the resolution, and that's why Hamas celebrated the resolution and welcomed it. That's why Iran welcomed it. Believe me, any resolution by the UN Security Council that Hamas welcomes is not a good resolution for Israel.
Minister, you were due to travel yesterday evening. Could you share with us what you said to the administration directly after that decision?
Well, I spoke to them. I haven't spoken to them after that decision. I spoke to them before that decision. When we first learned about which direction this was going, I did on, I think it was Sunday night. And when I heard what was happening, I said, look, you're going to have, it's the wrong message at the wrong time. I explained to you why it was the wrong message, because it's not connecting the issue of a ceasefire with the return of the hostages. And why is it such bad timing? Because we had negotiators in Doha trying to get an agreement to release hostages. And it's not surprising that Hamas decided to reject the latest proposal that was put forward by the Americans, because why? Why should they not reject it? They think they're going to get a ceasefire without giving up the hostages, because that's what the resolution said. And I understand and I appreciate that the United States has said that's not our policy, but that's not the text of the resolution. And that's the problem. And I told them before, if this would be the case, I would find it very difficult to believe that the prime minister would send a delegation to Washington. Why? Because the purpose of us going to Washington was to discuss and to actually listen to American ideas of how we should go into Rafah, the other ideas that they said they had, without a major military operation in Rafah. What message, John, is it going to send to Hamas that the day after that the Americans separate these two issues and say, you know what, you can have a ceasefire without a hostage negotiations, and then the United States is presenting its proposal how we should not go into Rafah? That's a real big problem, and that's why the prime minister made the right decision to stop the delegation, which I was leading, to go to Washington.
Okay, so this trip was suspended. Is there any plans for you to come to Washington then in the future?
I don't know. We'll have to discuss it with the U.S. administration. We haven't had those discussions yet. I think the context here was particularly problematic. Obviously, the U.S. has ideas, and I'm sure they'll share it with us. I don't know if it'll be in a delegation in Washington's people coming here, us speaking over the phone. But they have ideas that they want to present to us. The president asked the prime minister of Israel to send the delegation so that they can, we can hear their ideas. We have our defense minister in Washington now. I'm sure he's discussing this with them. But I think the timing was particularly problematic because of the message that this UN Security Council resolution was sending. It was a very, very bad message, both for the hostage negotiations. And also, we have to be very clear with Hamas. We have to be very clear that we're going to fight this war until the end. And the last thing we want them to believe that the international pressure on Israel will get us to simply not finish the war. That's not going to happen. Now, I don't decide what the United States will do or won't do. They're a sovereign government. They'll have to make their own decisions. But Israel has to make clear to Hamas that we intend to fight this fight till the very end. And hopefully that pressure, their understanding that we're going to fight this to the end, will enable us to get to a hostage deal.
Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, who is now on his way home, says he stressed in his talks with U.S. officials the importance of U.S.-Israel ties and of maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge in the region, including its air capabilities. Speaking to reporters, he, after his second day of talks with senior administration officials, he said, Israel shares 100% values with the United States and 99% interests. He stressed that the war in Gaza will end only when Hamas is destroyed and said a local alternative must be built up to govern the strip after Hamas is defeated. A reporter says the US is not imposing a veto on Israeli military action in Rafah, but is advocating a focused and surgical operation. IDF forces operating in the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank overnight killed three Palestinians during an anti-terror raid. Two armed terrorists were killed from the air. One was killed by sniper fire after throwing explosives at the Israeli forces. The troops also destroyed a vehicle where ready-to-use explosives were discovered. There were no Israeli casualties. The coalition crisis over the Haredi draft bill continues. Cabinet Secretary Yossi Fuchs blamed Defence Minister Yoav Gallant for the current deadlock, saying Gallant refused to cooperate with the government's efforts to find a solution. The Attorney General says she will not defend in court any government proposal that does not include enlistment quotas for the ultra-Orthodox. Haredi coalition partners have threatened to bolt the government if such quotas are introduced. A meeting last night between the Prime Minister and the heads of the Haredi Orthodox parties on a proposal regulating military service exemptions for the ultra-Orthodox ended without understandings. A reporter says Prime Minister Netanyahu raised the possibility of advancing a private members' bill on the matter after no agreement could be reached on a government proposal. Other elements in the coalition have objected to blanket exemptions, which have prompted a public outcry as the burden on those doing mandatory and reserve service in the military has been increased due to the war. The government decision that extended the military service exemptions for the Haredim is set to expire on Sunday. Reserve Major General Moti Almoz, who served as commander in the IDF Manpower Directorate, told Khan Radio that the day is drawing near when young people who do serve begin to rebel. He said on a day that 5,000 young people get a draft notice and they get on a bus and get off and say, send us wherever I'm needed. But if they don't come, we'll go to jail. That's all. I don't think we're that far away. Dr. Shuki Friedman is the Vice President of the Jewish People Policy Institute, the JPPI, and a member of the Faculty of Law at the Perez Academic Center. In a briefing today hosted by the Jerusalem Press Center, the Jerusalem Press Club, he spoke about some of the aspects of the ultra-Orthodox military exemption.
You know, basically, before the war, there had been a serious discussion in the Israeli society on whether to give up. There have been voices also from the left side and secular side of the Israeli society saying we basically don't need very large army. We need small and smart army and therefore not necessarily need the ultra-Orthodox drafting to the army. Let's give them a full exemption from the army service and enable them to join to the workforce, so at least we would not lose their ability to be part of the Israeli prosperous economy and be part of the workforce, because if we don't do this, we'll be in a lose-lose situation. We wouldn't get them to the army, and we wouldn't get them to the economy, then they will not pay taxes and one will not be part of the productive Israeli public. After the war, we realized that things change. It's not only about equality. It's about necessity for more soldiers through the borders. And we now, unfortunately, have to hold a larger army that we thought we need. It should be also smart, but we need more soldiers. And it's a zero-sum game. And if we don't recruit, we don't draft ultra-Orthodox, myself, my son, my friends, we'll have to serve more days in Milwim, in reserve service, and my younger boys that are going to draft his army soon will have to serve more months or year in the army instead of drafting the ultra-Orthodox. So we're not just talking about equality. We're talking about a necessity of security demands of the army to bring in more soldiers, to take this burden and to protect borders and to let us continue and survive, but also prosper. And if we don't bring them on, the people that are serving and paying taxes, we have to pay more and serve more. And it's unacceptable.
As the mother of three boys, I share your concern. One journalist is asking if you can provide a specific timeline over the legislative table that we're looking at. And I'll add a follow-up question. Do you think we're going to be seeing arrests in the streets in terms of implementing the law at the end of the day? Or is this just something that, you know, will dissipate?
You know, basically, the government should submit some draft laws soon, in the next few days. I think that up until the end of the month, and they just submitted a request from the court to give them more 10 days to negotiate. So basically, it should be happening very soon, and should accomplish this draft and legislate it up until June or so. So the time is very tough, and I think Prime Minister is focusing on trying to get any compromise in a very few hours, because they're going to vote on in the government, the cabinet, on the law now, today, I think, before Garland is getting back from D.C. Basically, I believe that they will put something on the table, otherwise the court will order to block all the budgets to the yeshivot, which would cause the Ultra-Orthodox to retire from the government, which is a crisis for itself. And then, so far, there have been some sort of patches to the or interpretation to the draft law that enable the government not to force it. But it's a good question what will happen in the near future. I assume we wouldn't see a mass arrests on the streets, but we definitely will see or the collapse of the government or appeal to the court that will block the ability of the Ultra-Orthodox community to continue this way, getting the budgets and so forth. And that will bring to a crisis, political crisis as well. So it's really hard to see arrests on the streets, but it's quite reasonable that we'll see a political crisis and also social crisis, because the people that are serving would not accept any unreasonable compromise.
One journalist has asked another question regarding ultra-Orthodox women, and asking that if the exemption is based on the study of Torah and there's no requirement for women to do so, why do they receive an exemption? Why is national service only voluntary and not compulsory? Mm-hmm.
Dr. Shuki Friedman is the VP at the Vice at the Jewish People Policy Institute and a member of the Faculty of Law at the Perez Academic Center. These are the stories making headlines at this hour. Staff Sergeant Nissim Kachlon from the Givati Brigade is killed in action in the southern Gaza Strip. Zaher Bashara, a Druze factory worker, is killed in a Hezbollah rocket strike in Kiryat Shmona. Troops discover a new tunnel network in Khan Yunis's Amal neighborhood. Efforts to reach a compromise on the Haredi IDF exemption bill are deadlocked. Three Palestinians are killed in an IDF raid on Jenin, and the weather unseasonably hot over the next few days. Ehud Banai brought out a new single this week called Matchil Litorer, Something's Stirring.
התורה בפתח בית הכנסת הגדול ברחוב שדל 5 מאות שנשמעים צלילים של סמבה בהופעה חיה מתערבבים במחשבות על אורן סוף ההוויה כאן שמעתי לפני 42 שנה את הרב מספר על העובר ברחם אמו איך רואה מקצה העולם ועד קצה הוא עטוף באולטרה סאונד של רחמים משהו רדום מתחיל זינגלה ממועדון בודג אתרון לבית מדרש בתל ברוך האחראי על המקום אמר שהוא מחפש גנן אמרתי לו שאני לגמרי בעניין בזמן שהם ישבו בפנים עם הגמרה אני בחוץ ניקשתי עשבים בזמן שהם נגנו על הבמה שמעתי קול קורא בין הצלילים
1980
משהו רדום מתחיל משל על מלך שמזמין את כל העם לארמון ומעמיד על הדרך מכשולים קשים צריך התעקשות גדולה רק מעטים זוכים 42 שנה מנקש ומתעקש עדיין בחצר לא בטרקלין הפנימי בפתח בית הכנסת הגדול מחוץ לשער בהמתנה לדבר האמיתי משהו
Ehud Banai. Former US President Donald Trump says October the 7th should never have happened. And if he had been president, it wouldn't have happened. Speaking to the Israel Hayom newspaper, he again called on Israel to end the war.
If I were president, you would have never been attacked because Iran was broke. They had no money. China couldn't buy oil from them because otherwise China wouldn't be able to deal with the United States. I said to China, I said to many nations, 47 nations, I spoke to many of them personally, if you buy oil from Iran, you will not do any business in the United States and we're going to tariff your products. Every single one of them agreed. I didn't lose one, not one. And Iran did almost no oil business. You know that. Nobody would buy oil because of me. They were broke. They had no money for Hamas. They had no money for Hezbollah. They had no money for anybody. And now they're sitting with $221 billion in cash, and they control Iraq, which has $300 billion in cash. It's like a subsidiary. Whether you like it or not, it's like a subsidiary because, stupidly, the United States went in and blew everything up. You know, you had two countries that were sort of equal in power, and one of them got blown up by the United States, and now Iran has a big advantage in the Middle East over a lot of other countries. When I saw October 7th, it was one of the saddest things I've ever seen because there was no reason for it. They would have never, ever done that for two reasons. Number one, they were broke. And number two, I was the president. They would have never done that because they knew there would have been very big consequences. All right. That being said, you have to finish up your war. You have to finish it up. You got to get it done. And I'm sure you'll do that. And we got to get to peace. You can't have this going on. And I will say, Israel has to be very careful because you're losing a lot of the world. You're losing a lot of support. But you have to finish up. You have to get the job done. And you have to get onto peace. You have to get onto a normal life for Israel and for everybody else.
So if you re-elect in a few months as once again to vice president, and Israel still may be in a war, how would you help Israel?
Well, look, there has been no president better to Israel than me. Iran wanted to make a deal. And with the deal, 90% of the deal that I want to make is no nuclear weapon. That's 90%, almost 100%. It might be 100%. That's all I want. No nuclear weapon for Iran. And it's so sad when I see what's happening in Israel and Ukraine and other places, many other places. Inflation. You take a look at inflation. We wouldn't have had inflation that was caused by his stupid energy policies. And it's too bad. He's the worst president in the history of our country. I'm a very loyal person. I've been loyal to Israel. I've been the best president in history by a factor of 10 to Israel because of all the things I do. The embassy, Jerusalem being the capital, the best location for the embassy, and getting the embassy built. But then you have Abraham Accords, and then you have Golan Heights. Nobody even thought that was going to be possible. I did that, and I did it because of a lot of reasons. Israel has to do what they have to do, but we have to get to peace because the world is turning, and it's not a good thing for Israel. What's happening is not a good thing.
I want to show with you a question that in our minds, every leader in the world should reply. How would you react if, God forbid, it was your children or grandchildren who were kidnapped by Hamas or suffering the horrors that so many Israelis were going through on October 7?
On October 7? I would say I would act very much the same way as you did. You'd have to be crazy not to. Only a fool would not do that. That was a horrible attack.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump. Families of the hostages being held by Hamas clashed with Knesset members in the Knesset House Committee on Tuesday after the committee voted to allow the Knesset to go on recess. I'm not disrespecting everything you're doing, but why is it so urgent for you to go on recess, said Chen Avigdori, whose family was kidnapped by Hamas and released in November. Avigdori's niece's husband is still being held hostage. United Torah Judaism Knesset member Yitzhak Pindros jeered at Avigdori, telling him, yalla yalla, which means come on, come on. Relatives of the hostages responded with outrage, and one said, yalla yalla, you can tell your mother. Here is Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros with Yalla Yalla.
Yalla Yalla. not in my time. But in our sons and daughters' time, when you get the feeling, call when you got a room. Meantime, we're cutting our hands at the keypad shop in the streets of fear. We're getting all our best taekwondo moves on a barrel of beer. We're trying to get a signal on a regular FM through the TTI of a CNN. They're sucking the wine right out of the vine, splitting it out again. Grooving, let's cut out of the scene. Go grooving. In the streets of fear, forgetting all those best taekwondo moves on a barrel of beer. Trying to get a signal through from Ragger FM to the TTI bus, CNN. Sucking this wine right out of the vine, and I'd spend it back again. Grooving, let's cut out of the scene. Go grooving. Grooving, let's cut out. Single cruising.
And the Mescaleros with Yalla Yalla. Amid the growing shortage of doctors in Israel against a backdrop of the war, the Ministry of Aliyah and Integration, together with the Ministry of Health and the Nefesh B'Nefesh organization, are launching an initiative to ease the immigration process for physicians from abroad and streamline their integration in medical facilities in Israel's north and south. The initiative will be launched tomorrow morning in an event at Ziv Hospital in Tzfat. Reporter Nomi Segal spoke with Dr. Rimon Levy of Ziv Hospital, who described his own experience when he returned to Israel for his residency.
I finished my studies in the U.S., and my wife was was pregnant and she just gave birth, and we made the decision that I wanted him to grow up in Israel. I kind of had to make a decision if to continue the studies or to continue my residency in the States or to come to Israel. And we decided at that point that we wanted to come back to Israel. And so at the end of 2019, literally December 31st, we landed in Israel, and the next day I started my residency in Ziv Hospital in Tzfat. And from the beginning, they were very excited to have a doctor who decided to come back to Israel and join the hospital, and welcomed me very nicely. And I was very pleased with the program over here at Ziv Hospital, and decided that I wanted also, after like finishing the stage year, the preliminary intern year, to continue my residency.
Some doctors, or perhaps those who are already have become certified abroad and then immigrate to Israel, it can sometimes be challenging to come and go through that process here. Is that something that you've encountered, even just speaking to other colleagues?
Yeah, definitely. So I did have the advantage of growing up in Israel, and then my mother's American, so I've lived in the States when I finished my army service, and I've been there for almost 18 years before coming back. So I did have the advantage of the language, even though I was a little bit rough around the edges, but it was I was able to pick up my skills quickly. The nice thing about the program now is that they're offering now that they're going to have focus on aid with Hebrew studies, preparing new doctors to come to Israel when they already have some benefit of the language, like I had. It definitely made things easy for me having the language, and if there's a program like they now offer to make things easier, it's definitely going to be a big advantage. Okay, so this is what they're trying to do now in this new program, to encourage the doctors to come, to make it much more seamless movement. And there was, you know, I did have to deal with some bureaucracy at the time, and just figuring things on my own. But again, I had the advantage of familiarity a little bit, and I have had relatives in Israel that were able to help. I think with this new program, it's making the move here way more accessible.
Now, Israel has for some time had a shortage of doctors. Certainly since the war, perhaps that's more acute. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience, if there is a sense of an impact?
There's definitely a sense for a need for doctors, especially in the north. It always seems to be that way, where in the periphery there's more need. And especially now with the war, there's even more need. Especially now we're in the north, our hospital services much of the northern areas. This is a hospital that was also involved even in helping Syrian refugees at some point during the Syrian civil war. So we definitely could use more doctors here in the north, and there's a lot that the north has to offer. I feel myself very lucky to be here, and it worked out very well for me, this move here. And I can tell you, being here at this time of war even gives it that much more meaning.
How will this program work for those who are interested to come now?
The Ministry of Aliyah are going to help promote this program together with international groups such as Nefesh Benefesh that's overseas, okay? And they're with that, they're going to have these Hebrew online studies that's geared specifically to address the doctor community. Okay, so it's like learning the terminology in Hebrew that's like relevant, and getting more familiarized with Israeli medical system, okay, and especially easing up with all the bureaucracy and not having to deal with the red tape and things like that. They're gonna do a lot of the back work behind the scenes to make it as seamless as possible.
Dr. Rimon Levy of Ziv Hospital. Popular Israeli singer and actor Idan Amedi, who was wounded in the Gaza Strip during combat reserve duty in the war, has turned down an offer to light a ceremonial torch at the main state ceremony on Mount Herzl that marks the start of Israel's Independence Day, and whose theme this year is Israeli heroism. In an Instagram post, Amedi wrote, "There's no greater honor, but unfortunately I cannot accept it this year. So many heroes were discovered on that same Black Shabbat. Some were my troops in the past or in the current war. This year I'll stay home and commune with their memory. Like many others in the nation of Israel, I hope perhaps in the future I will be granted the merit to raise a torch thanks to the words I write and not due to war heroism." Israel's national soccer team coach, Alon Chazan, has been fired. The chair of Israel's Soccer Federation said that while Chazan served Israeli soccer wonderfully, Israel's failure to advance to the Euros 2024 finals requires changes to the professional staff. Investigators have boarded the container ship which crashed into a bridge in the U.S. city of Baltimore and recovered its data recorder, officials say. Six people are presumed dead after the collision involving the Singapore-flagged Dali, which struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge as it left port on Tuesday. Two victims have so far been named. The bridge snapped and plunged into the river, and the Dali container ship crashed into it. After the Dali container ship crashed into it, the vessel had lost power and issued a distressed call moments before, but could not change course in time to avoid crashing into the bridge. President Biden has said that the US government will cover the entire cost of rebuilding the bridge. An increase in beatings, vandalism, and episodes of racism against Central Asian migrants has been reported in Russia since the deadly attacks at the Moscow Crocus City Hall last Friday. Four Tajik nationals have been accused of killing 140 people in the attack, claimed by jihadist group Islamic State. Several other suspects have been arrested, all of Central Asian origin. Forecasting a rise in tensions in the aftermath of the Moscow murders, the embassy of Tajikistan in Russia warned its citizens at the weekend not to leave their homes unless necessary. Central Asian migrants make up a sizable portion of Russia's migrant labor population, particularly in the rental, transportation, and construction sectors. Now, Maisa Kara with the Arabic version of White Rabbit.
السؤال اللي لقيت ما ذكرت الف
Maisakara with the Arabic version of White Rabbit. The weather is unseasonably hot tomorrow. To Sharav heatwave conditions over most of the country. Friday, slightly cooler, particularly in the centre and the south, but still hot for the time of year, with light rain possible in the south and the east from the afternoon. Saturday, still unseasonably hot, with showers possible, particularly in the hills and in the east. Max temperatures tonight and tomorrow, Jerusalem 11 to 26, Tel Aviv 14 to 25, Haifa 16 to 26, Tzfat 11 to 23, Tiberias 12 to 30, Beersheva 15 to 32, and Inilat from 18 tonight, rising to 33 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Another look at the main headlines at this hour. Staff Sergeant Nissim Kahlon from the Givati Brigade is killed in action in the southern Gaza Strip. Zaher Bashara, a Druze factory worker, is killed in a Hezbollah rocket strike in Kiryat Shmona. Troops discover a new tunnel network in the Khan Yunis's Amal neighborhood. Efforts to reach a compromise on the Haredi IDF exemption bill are deadlocked. Three Palestinians are killed during an IDF raid on Jenin. Hamas has released a recording of its military chief in Gaza, Mohammed Deif. Israel wants to reschedule the talks in Washington that it cancelled this week after the United Nations Security Council vote. And the weather unseasonably hot over the next few days. That's the news. Join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kan Reka, the foreign languages channel of the Israel Public Broadcasting Corporation. This is Mark Weiss wishing you good evening and shalom from Jerusalem.